Hey everyone, welcome to the Compass Podcast. Today I am joined by Leo Zhang. We're going to talk about the intelligent Bitcoin miner, a piece that he has put out. There's actually two parts to this already, and we're going to dive into both of them, talking about things like, you know, should you buy Bitcoin or mine Bitcoin? What makes for a profitable miner? And we'll probably get into MEV as well, because look, I don't get a chance to talk to people as smart as Leo very often. No offense to anybody else who's been on the podcast, but Leo's a mega brain. He is, I don't know, I think some people would call the king of hash rate research. So it'll be awesome to get to chat with him there. But I hope you guys enjoy this conversation with Leo. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. If you do, please consider subscribing and leaving a review on your preferred listening platform. It really helps out the show. The Compass Podcast is presented commercial free by Compass, the number one Bitcoin mining marketplace. If you want to get started mining Bitcoin, source hard to find ASICs, or find competitively priced hosting space, then check Compass out at compassmining.io. And now, on to the show. Leo, what's up, buddy? How you doing?
Good. Glad to be here again.
King of hash rate.
I would prefer to be known as the enchanted broccoli of hash rate.
What is enchanted broccoli?
Yeah, so it's a house back at Stanford. It's called Enchanted Broccoli Forest. It's where, you know, most kids would just smoke a lot of joint and hang out. So it's called Enchanted Broccoli Forest. It has a very fond memory in my heart. My best memories of Stanford days.
That's it. What'd you study at Stanford? Enchanted Broccoli.
I study mathematics.
So let's get into to these pieces, man. I know both of them are fantastic, very meaty. Anyone who is not familiar with Anitza Research, Leo's website, and what he's been working on now for, I guess, almost a full year, a little bit over a year already, right?
Yes.
It's awesome. There's a ton of great information on there. We're focusing specifically on the piece that he released about 5 days ago, and then there was one just before that. The series is The Intelligent Bitcoin Miner. It's Leo, Jack Kohler, Kareem Helmy has helped as well. And then there was somebody else. I'm blanking on his name right now, but he helped with research on the first piece.
Yeah, it's David Tsai from General Mining Research. General Mining Research is one of the largest mining groups in China. It's not very well known outside of the circle, but yeah, they're a group of whale.
They are. Really nice guys too. Really nice guys. Shout out to Rui. Had a conversation with him not too long ago. Anyways, getting into this, man, what led you to write or to start down the path of researching what it means to be an intelligent Bitcoin miner, and what led to the writing of these pieces?
Yeah, so I think for this series, The Intelligent Bitcoin Miner, the main focus is really on how to price hash rate and specifically how to price machines. Because it's no secret that machine pricing is very difficult because it's very complex, involves a lot of complex financial variables, but as well as physical attributes, right? And not to mention the supply chains, and there's always a lot of inefficiencies in these information. So I know people have attempted at coming up with, you know, general framework or just very simple metrics for benchmarking where the return is by, you know, using stuff like static days of return, static break even day, which is pretty much the same concept, cost of production based on, you know, snapshot 1 day difficulty and price. But these are the limitation of these metrics are also very clear, very obvious. So in order to capture the future uncertainties of hash power production for, you know, cash flow, we need to establish some kind of basic understanding of how these variables evolve in the future and what are some of the things that can influence the fluctuation of these variables and how do the fluctuation of these variables in turn affect the overall profitability of the miners.
So let's jump in on that real quick. So there's a lot to that. So for anyone who's listening who maybe is new to mining, you know, backing it up to some of the things that Leo has already mentioned, when it comes to break even, that's when you're looking at, you know, basically returning on your initial investment for the equipment that you're purchasing. Often that is, you know, air quotes counted based on static factors like price of Bitcoin, hash rate, total network hash rate, difficulty. But it's a very imprecise calculation because none of these things are the same every day, right? They change every day. And often the break even is not readjusted accordingly. It's just this fixed thing that people put in their mind, I'm going to break even on my machines in 11 months. And then that tends to be the calculation that they keep. However, it does change. Okay. So as we're breaking this down and we're talking about how these are going, how these are moving, what did you come to and what's the best way to truly track this if you wanted to make these projections on, you know, what a machine break even would look like?
Yeah. So at the end of the day, it's still very difficult to model this, especially for something that's complex because the dimensionality of this specific exercise is too large. But the with all you know modeling process, the core thing process is to identify the key attributes and narrow down to how they're connected and how to project them and how just think about how they change in general. So the part one of the series is mainly focused on establishing these key attributes. So I identified a couple of key characteristics that are, you know, very commonly discussed among the mining community, and as well as, you know, this kind of strategy of Bitcoin miners tend to use, because this does affect your overall output a lot, but it's seldom discussed, you know, whether the miner is selling everything that he or she mined every day, or they're keeping majority of the coins, but selling just enough to cover the operating expenses. So I think there is a full spectrum of ranging from opportunistic approach where just want to capture the delta between the price of Bitcoin versus cost production of that day to the more conservative side, more long Bitcoin strategy, which is just trying to use Bitcoin mining as a way to accumulate as many Bitcoin as possible. So I think most miners, they fall in somewhere between, and this is not, you know, a fixed strategy. Not everyone wake up, start the operation and decide, oh, I'm going to be one of these three strategy.
Sure.
Yeah. So this change. And of course, when the market environment changed, different strategy, they perform differently. So what we want to establish in part one of the series is really just to illustrate how to put these factors together and to show, okay, how these different strategies react in different market environments. There sometimes it's better to just sell every day. There's some environments where it's better to keep as much Bitcoin as possible. And of course, one can argue that on long enough of time horizon, it's always better to keep as many Bitcoins as possible.
Sure.
But in absence
of
that
survive,
mindset,
right? Like yeah. You have to survive for that length of time. Like the breakdown that you did in part one, for anyone who hasn't yet read it, it's, you know, basically January 1, 2018 through to the end of the year, right? Or 2019 through to the end of the year. So you took one full year as the snapshot. Is that right? Or was it 2 years?
I think I started with 1 year, and we also look at 6 months.
Yeah. So the 6 month period, basically you had the three strategies, right? The moderate strategy, which is, you know, covering your power and covering your depreciation of the hardware, right? And then you have your long BTC strategy, which is just covering your power and then holding everything else in Bitcoin. And then your sell everything strategy, which is selling what you mine on a daily basis. And then, you know, over the course of the year, basically everyone lost money because of market conditions. All three strategies lost money, but the least amount of money was lost by the person that was selling every day. But then as you break it down and you talk about, you know, turning off machines and how the strategy can develop, you know, actually the person who sold daily would have made a little bit of money if they play the market correctly. So that speaks to the fact that, you know, you don't just go in with one mindset and that's your strategy and this is what you're going to do forever. There needs to be a level of fluidity in the market. Now, to that point though, do you think that right now, because I mean, it seems to me like, you know, miners are basically on the long Bitcoin strategy, right? They're just selling enough to cover power and then holding the rest. Is this the big thing that's leading to this the supply crunch that's driving the price up at the moment?
So I think it's a little hard to tell what is the dominant strategy of Bitcoin miners these days, because, you know, there are new players in coming with very different risk considerations, very different capital characteristics, right? Some of them have access to cash that enable them to mine at loss when the mining cycle is not that favorable. But I would imagine most people who are at this point in time, right, just given where the trajectory of coin price, most people want to preserve as many Bitcoins as possible. But again, I think the overall volume of Bitcoin that's being sold by miners, even if they're selling daily, if there's only, you know, 900, roughly around 900 Bitcoin per day. So that's nothing compared to the actual daily trading volume of Bitcoin on market. So I think, you know, the time that when miners were able to influence the market price, I think that's long gone. I think it's all funds, traders, apes.
So you think that now there's no way for the miners to influence price?
I think it's hard. Think it's hard. And also they're not going to use production. They have to use inventory.
Sure. You know,
it's foreseeable. It's possible that a miner is just dumping on the market with everything that he's ever mined. But that's different from, you know, selling daily production. There's only 900 Bitcoin that go into the miner's hand roughly on a daily basis.
Yeah. Okay. So do you mine or do you buy? This is the question.
That is the question. So we try to answer that question We try to model this question, this comparison in part one of the series as well. So every time we run a scenario and compare the profitability of the three strategy, we also compare them against dollar cost averaging and also just buy upfront. So there are definitely scenarios where it's much more profitable to just dollar cost average. And there was one scenario, if I remember correctly, that's you would make absolute killing by just buying a hold. But this is all based on backtesting. And when you're backtesting, everything seems just like a no-brainer. But when you're living through that moment and looking at future, it's very difficult to make that judgment. So I think at the end of the day, it's these are all ways for analysts to dissect the history and try to pick up little patterns from the past. But you know, this is an evolving industry. Bitcoin itself is evolving. The mining is definitely evolving. The game is changing every day. So it's difficult to just straight up apply what happened in the past to the present and project the future. But overall, I hope that we provide tools that help people with assumptions to craft their analysis.
That is a very, very politically correct answer. The answer is both. You do both. You mine and you buy. You do both. But in all of your research though, what did you deduce? I mean, what were your feelings based on the information that you were finding?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, for people who want to achieve certain goal, which is really just accumulate as much Bitcoin as possible, right? It really depends on their access to power. If you're mm-hmm. someone who is mining on, you know, 6 cent electricity, it's probably better for you to just use that money and go dollar cost averaging. But if you have, if you can secure 3 cent electricity and your maintenance, your technicians, you have all these taken care of, the chance that you're going to make a lot more Bitcoin compared to just go out there, go on the market and purchase is probably higher. So I think it's difficult to establish a general framework because I think this is very, very case by case. Depends on the group's skill set, access to resources, what kind of resources they have. The answer is going to be very different. So our goal is not to provide investment advice in the sense that like whether it's better to do one or the other, but to provide a framework of thinking, tools.
Sure. Yeah. And that makes sense. I'm just, you know, forcing you to an opinion of your own. It's what we got to do. You know, when you get into the next part of part one, the next section of part one, talking about your hash power pricing, this is something that you've dove into multiple times, but how does the pricing of hash rate play into all of the research that you did for Intelligent Bitcoin Miner part one and part two?
Yeah. So I think in this series, we started to use simulation instead of some kind of theoretical model to do this exercise. I think it's definitely easier to just given the number of variables, it's much easier to do a simulation instead of coming up with some kind of equivalent of Black-Scholes for this. Because inherently, we tried that in the past, and I think anything that we come up with inherently falls short on certain assumptions, particularly assumptions around the underlying time series. But with simulation, there's still a lot of problems. We still have to make a lot of assumptions, especially, you know, the distribution of Bitcoin price, connections between the connections of a hash rate. So in part one of the series, what we did was we used something called a jump diffusion model to model Bitcoin price. And this is a very common practice. Not common, I'm sorry, but this is a practice that's been discussed before. And the problem is we used a linear function to describe the relationship between global hash rate and price. And this is sort of a very lazy approach. But at that time, it was it was advanced enough of a paper to be introduced to the community. But I've always just sort of been like very wary of that specific part. So after part one, it was very obvious to me that we need to take this to the next level. And the way we do this, and actually this is something already mentioned at the end of the part one, that in order for this to be really good or at least improve the accuracy of the model, we need to use something called agent-based simulation. And the basic idea is that, you know, every miner is different, right? Every miner react to the market differently, and they're just each little individuals that sort of experiences these changes in the market at the same time, but they produce different outputs. So, you know, Bitcoin goes up by a certain percentage, miner A and miner B are going to have a different reaction. So, the idea in part two is that instead of modeling global hash rate as a function of price, we break it into different individual miners with very different characteristics, miners who run different machines, miners who run at different electricity. So we sort of model miners into these individual miner class, and each miner looks slightly different. So Bitcoin price becomes this independent input that every day feeds into these miners, and each miner produces a profit or loss. And this is going to be different for a different miner with different characteristics. And these profit or loss in turn drive, and also strategy has been taken into consideration as well. So the different profit or loss in turn drive the miner's decision if they want to shut up machines or buy more machines. And therefore it spit out a hash rate output, and a sum of all the miners' hash rate becomes the new global hash rate. So I think this bottom-up approach makes much more sense, and it introduces enough like random factors such that the hash rate doesn't look like a rigid function that's just responding to price, which we know is not the case. So I think it is a huge improvement over what we had in part one, but still it would still fail to catch a lot of the variables, and it's impossible to scram all of them into this model. But yeah, so after part one, I wanted to do this, and we recruited Kareem, who I really liked from some of our conversation that we had, mm-hmm. and he volunteered to help us with the implementation. So yeah, so after several months of crafting this model, part two is the final result.
So when it comes to machine pricing, I mean, this is something that I think most people who are new to the market don't understand. And the pricing is somewhat nebulous. I mean, often you hear people say that the manufacturers price based on, you know, a 9-month break even or an 8-month break even period for the buyer. But it's not quite clear. It just, all we know is that as the price of Bitcoin goes up, the price of the ASICs go up. So how is that factored into the model? And are you able to lay out a clearer equation as to how these ASICs are being priced?
So the best we can do is to provide like a fair theoretical value based on the assumptions that the user of the model have. At the end of the day, the pricing of the ASICs is all supply and demand, right? And, you know, especially in this market, I'm sure you guys see this better than I do. When the demand is high, you're going to see all sorts of pricing. And especially these days when everyone's just knocking on the manufacturer's door, they have a lot of leverage. They can, you know, choose, they can select, they can price differently to different clients based on the relationship. So there are a lot of human factors, a lot of psychological factors in play here that makes it hairy to create a theoretical model. But we still want to try to establish some kind of a basic framework so that hopefully the market consensus can converge to something closer to that. At the end of the day, the biggest problem is the liquidity of these instruments. By instruments, I mean machines. Because mm-hmm. machine is a hash power contract, right? It's a contract in the generalized abstract sense. It's a physical contract. And in order to have price discovery on this, you need to trade them. You have to observe the trading activities of these things. And it's hard. You have to unplug your machine, ship it to somewhere else, wait for, you know, God knows how long. And you have to pay for transportation, insurance, and whatnot in order for it. So it's, well, it's not the first time that humanity have the markets have to deal with this problem. This is how, you know, options and futures are established for traditional commodities. You know, olives, corn, all these. We've seen this many times. So I think this is definitely a little bit more complex, but it's not a different species.
Sure. This segues quite nicely into something that I wanted to discuss with you, because I mean, of all of the research that you've done, and I know a lot of the conversations that you're having behind the scenes, there's probably not a better person that we can talk to about MEV, right? There's a ton of questions that I have about MEV. First, I want to hear it in your words. Let's start from the top. What is MEV?
Yeah. So MEV it's a pretty unique phenomenon that that's in permissionless blockchain that's not observed. There's something similar in traditional markets, but not entirely quite like this. And this is definitely the biggest on Ethereum, just due to the growing on-chain complexity. So these DeFi primitives have produced a lot of very interesting behavior, right? And because most of the transactions are public on the mempool, and it creates incentive for bots to constantly observe these mempools to pick up, to identify arbitrage opportunities. And there are tons of these, right? Because, you know, all trades on Unit go to Uniswap. These are something, if you have the right tool, these are visible. So for instance, if a bot, and this happened way before this idea has been formalized. So for instance, if a bot identified a arbitrage opportunity that someone else has placed on the mempool.
Yes.
And this bot can sort of, the simplest way to capture is just simply pay for a higher gas, yes, and try to front run. Yeah, run this.
Yeah.
And if other bots see this opportunity too, they start a bidding war. And this this phenomenon is called priority gas auction. And this is part of the reason why at times gas costs become so high. It's because of these little bidding wars. And of course, with this is just the most simple form of mempool arbitrage, but there can be a lot of very complex kind of attack, such as sandwich attack, where bots actually see a transaction and places a bid and sell before and after that transaction, such that, you know, it puts a tax on the user. So Phil Dion, he formalized this phenomenon in a paper called Flashboy 2.0. Sorry, I was blanking out. And this stuff, this immediately created a ripple, a wide discussion among the community, and people realized, wow, this is actually really serious. And people start realize, oh, MEV is an inevitability due to the growing complexity on chain, and it's very difficult, almost impossible to just not technically impossible, but just in terms of incentive, it's very difficult to erase this. So there are different thoughts on how to mitigate this, because it's possible that MEV is going to be toxic to Ethereum, because it sort of incentivizes a lot of different, some very interesting attack models, such as, you know, miner try to extract these themselves. They try to censor, yes, transactions and take the arbitrage opportunity for themselves, or a time bandit attack, which is really just these short term reorgs that if miner identified, they think it's more profitable for them to capture those themselves. So yeah, there are several threads of discussion on this. Is definitely a still developing phenomenal, but Flashbots, for instance, is probably the most paid probably the project that has captured the most attention, because it has the smartest Ethereum people working on this, discussing this. So the basic idea is that, just, you know, instead of trying to stop this from happening, just to make it a little bit more transparent. So the sequencing part, you know, transaction sequencing has been auctioned out of the miner's hand, so that people can pay sort of this part of the mining infrastructure for the right to structure, to sequence transaction in a order that they want.
So question on that. So when it comes to the sequencing of events, obviously it's to front run. So is there, I mean, other than to make sure that your transactions are included in a particular order, is there any other reason for this? I mean, front running, it sounds like front running and then potentially malicious behavior are the only two incentives behind it. Is that correct?
Yeah, you can play offensive or defensive here, right? So by offensive, I'm really mean like you want to cap, you want these transactions that that you initiate to happen in a certain sequence, such that you make sure that this the kind of outcome that you're expecting has a determined relative deterministic outcome. And defensive in the sense that if you're going to place a large order of some sort on some kind of on-chain infrastructure, you want to make sure that it doesn't get sandwiched by any other players. You want to make sure that there's enough of sort of transaction buffers that that make sure also just to guarantee the outcome that you hope to achieve. And of course, for professional traders, the kind of games that you can play in with this is quite creative. But the central idea here is that, you know, miner used to control two things, right? One is, well, miner still control two things. One is transaction inclusion, and the second is transaction ordering. But by miner, I'm really talking about mining pool operators, because miners don't, so each individual miners don't really have that power. So in the past, transaction inclusion is where most of the mining pools try to optimize, right? So there's a specific type of strategy for including to pick up transactions from the main pool. But there's nothing has been done to, for at least for the mining pool, to think about, okay, how do we sequence these transactions? Because it really didn't matter to them. But now it's sort of, if this part is being auctioned now, unless the miners are actively participating in sequencing themselves, which they don't really have incentive unless they're traders.
Sure.
They can actually capture more money by letting other people, other parts of the infrastructure, outsource the part of the specific part to other part of the community who actually have incentive to submit this sequence of block.
And now we're seeing that, right, with Flashbots partnering with a lot of the ETH mining pools, right? We're seeing these partnerships come to pass.
Yeah, I think we're seeing over, I don't remember the latest number, but something like 60% of Ethereum, total Ethereum hash rate is running on Flashbots now. I think this is inevitable. And I think all the incentive for mining pools to provide the service is also there, right? Because this is additional earning for miners, especially
of
in
course.
Light of EIP-1559 and God knows when transition to ETH2. It's
okay, just a lot of we got to jump it on that. So EIP-1559, how does that play with Flashbots? I mean, now that you have this this improvement protocol that's happening, what does that do? How does that impact MEV, or does it impact MEV?
So I think the impact is indirect, but of course these things are all connected, right? The base fee is supposed to be, so one thing for sure is miners are going to earn less.
Sure.
But the incentive to, I think it's just transferring this connection between the payer and the receiver of the tip to a different lane, if that makes sense.
But now, so, okay, EIP 1559 decreases the profitability for miners. There's been the argument that this doesn't decrease transaction fees, but it still makes mining less profitable for ETH miners. But with, okay, so with Flashbots and EIP 1559, does this actually continue to push the transaction fees higher because now there are entities competing for the order of those transactions through Flashbots?
So the hope of Flashbots is that it can actually manage to push the transaction fee down, because the priority gas auction, right, these active bidding war, they happen separately from what the rest of mempool is seeing. Because, so a poor analogy would be, it's sort of everyone is running on this open field. And when these bidding war happens, other people who don't really have this need to be part of this gets dragged along, and therefore the overall fee is higher. But now you sort of create this super highway, right? This highway that people who are interested in this bidding war, they drive to that highway, and the rest of the lanes, they can take their own, they can drive at their own pace.
Got it. So now what happens when we go to ETH 2.0 in 15 years?
Yeah, I don't know. So this is definitely being actively discussed. So in theory, validators can also, this can also happen to a validator network. It's possible that, you know, slashing can mitigate the kind of reorgs, the time bandit attack that that threatens Ethereum in the current format. But I think a lot of I haven't been following ETH 2.0 close enough to understand its exact shape.
Still early, right? You got time to figure out ETH 2.0.
Yeah, but there are so rollups has been discussed as a possible way to sort of mitigate this, because so for instance, optimism, they separate the sequencing and inclusion, or at least that's the idea last time I checked. But again, there's also a problem with cross roll up, because it breaks the synchrony of so how do you know different roll ups communicate? This definitely would require some asynchronous blockchain application development. But that's pretty bleeding edge stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's still going to be the need, the desire for, you know, the proactive and reactive and the offensive and defensive positioning of these transactions in the blocks, right? Whether it's with proof of stake or with mining. So, I mean, if we're talking about node validators, personal opinion is moving to proof of stake is going to further centralize the system, right? It's going to put, I think, a greater amount of power in fewer people's hands when it comes to ETH or any proof of stake system. So does this then, God, man, it's going to be crazy to see how these node validators will be able to influence the way that transactions are structured. Do you have any thoughts on what this could look like for MEV?
Yeah, it's difficult to generalize right now, and I'm not saying this just to hedge my position, but I truly don't know.
Sure, of course. Yeah.
So I've read all the arguments that suggest that these validators are going to just become centralized service providers, right? And I think it does seem like it makes sense. But on the other side of the spectrum, proof of work is also getting more and more expensive. There are larger facilities being raised by people who have a lot more capital. So like industrialization, sure, is an inevitable trend for proof of work. But one thing that can happen to sort of like slightly mitigate this is exactly what you guys do, right? To break a larger player into smaller pieces and have, mm-hmm, different people own it, right? Right? But still, it doesn't change the fact that an operation, each individual operation, regardless of who owns it, is getting more and more expensive.
Yes, agreed. Yeah, I think the difference between proof of work and proof of stake is I can buy one ASIC and put it on the network. And I mean, I may have, it's a drop in the bucket, but I'm at least in the bucket, right? When it comes to proof of stake, you have to meet a minimum amount of ETH to stake, right? Like I can buy one ETH and it does nothing. I'm not a drop in the bucket. I'm nothing. So you have nodes, you have, you know, the people who can run a node, and then you have the people who are just buying ETH. There's no in between. Like, you know, buying one doesn't make you a participant in the network, which is the big differentiator. But I mean, who knows at this point what it's going to look like? All we have to look at are smaller chains with many less participants and, you know, far less at stake, no pun intended, than what we're going to see with ETH. So where do we go from here, man? Where do we go from here? You've got flash bots that are accounting for 60% of the hash rate on ETH, or of the blocks that are being mined on ETH. What does this look like from here, assuming that nothing changes, assuming we're not going to ETH 2.0 in the next 6 months?
Yeah, I actually think this is there will be a lot more this type of centralized service providers. And by centralized, it doesn't necessarily mean that one group versus like one group owning a lot of hash power, but really just like one group that's working on owning a specific layer of the stack, right? So I think it looks like Flashbots is going to be hard to compete against in foreseeable amount of time, unless someone else forked their code and launched a token and everyone wants to buy that token. We've seen that game being played before. But of course, my point is, I think I see them as service providers, right? And I think more of the more layers of the mining stack is going to become professionalized around these service providers, which may or may not be a good thing. I think it's good in the sense that, like, for users, they know exactly what they're getting into. Mm-hmm. They know if they want to achieve some outcome, what they need to do, who they need to talk to, how do they need to structure their transaction in a specific way. The bad part is obviously this becomes more and more of each little individual power factions that own piece of this whole system. And of course, it's already pretty established that Ethereum is very different from Bitcoin, and it does very different things from Bitcoin. So it could just, you know, people just don't really care about that, and it excel in the direction that it wants to go. But at the same time, we're seeing other, you know, layer one solutions emerge. I don't have very strong opinion about that. I think it's just a bull market phenomenon. But if these these guys keep developing and offer better solutions, it's possible that some volume may move elsewhere.
Especially if they can figure out how to maintain MEV with proof of stake. You know, if that's able to be proven out, then I think there's a lot of carryover to the other layer ones. But you mentioned the differences between Bitcoin and ETH. How about similarities? Is there a way that MEV can work on Bitcoin?
In theory, yes. So when the block subsidy continues to diminish, and also when it is also possible for Lightning channels, but however, it's much easier for Bitcoin to mitigate MEV compared to Ethereum. And the Ethereum, the biggest problem is on-chain complexity as well. It's statefulness. But for Bitcoin, I think it's easier to mitigate. And also, it's not really a problem anytime soon.
But couldn't it be a benefit? I see it as an edge, right? Like, if you're looking at this as a miner, this is an additional profit center for you, right? It's a nice service that Flashbots is providing. But if it was available on Bitcoin, why is it more difficult on Bitcoin than it would be on ETH?
Yeah, I think the biggest concern is really the time bandit attack. That these rapid short reorgs that destabilize the consensus. That's the biggest threat of that MEV brings to permissionless blockchains. So for ETH, the temporary patch solution is to auction off the sequencing part. For Bitcoin, one, I don't know on which layer of the site this is going to happen. It could be something that strictly happened on Lightning channels. If most of the sort of like equivalent of arbitrage opportunities happen there, yeah, I think there are still a lot of unknown regarding MEV on Bitcoin. But overall, I think this is not happening anytime soon, or we're not going to observe that anytime soon.
Well, damn. No, look, Leo, I think that this is this continues to be a fascinating thing. MEV, I mean, when we were talking to VCs during Compass's raise in the, in late Q4 of 2020, MEV was all venture capitalists could talk about. It was like, if you mentioned mining, they were hopeful that it was MEV. And I think that we're going to continue to see this grow. Flashbots has obviously proven out that there's a tremendous demand for this. And I don't know if anyone will be able to step in and compete with them. Probably not. The team there is fantastic, but this is just a fascinating part of this industry. It would be awesome to see it come through for Bitcoin as well. Although it sounds like you think that that's a stretch. Okay. We're in a bull market. Are we in a super cycle?
What's a super cycle?
Are we going to see a 2 to 3 year extended run up before we get a cool down?
Oh man. I'm actually a little, I'm not entirely optimistic about this.
You almost said bearish.
Of course, I think it's hard to time this. It could be 2 months. It could be 2 years. But yeah, I mean, the fact that Dogecoin is so up there has proven that this is all just games now. But it has always been the case, right? This is nothing. There's nothing to lament about this. But the problem with that is this is all based on the emergence of market consensus, and which come and go.
Sure.
And this also just makes mining difficult to time, because on one hand you have something so your decision, most people's decision making process is based on inputs from coin price, right? Or in Ethereum's case, fees. And these are things that change very quickly.
Yeah.
But the execution of the decisions from this is something very heavy, takes a long time, and you're stuck with them for a long time. So yeah, that's why mining cycle works a little differently from just coin cycles. You can have a period of time where coin price is very high, but you're still suffering.
True. So Leo, before we wrap things up, man, one question that I always ask everyone, especially in a market like this, what are you the most excited about right now?
My project, which is coming out in 2-3 months. I've been working on this thing for over a year, and this just one thing and one thing only I've been thinking about and working on. I mean, I think for people who have read my article, it's pretty obvious what it's going to be, although the implementation is shockingly elegant. It's just
well said.
Yeah, because everything I've written, everything I've talked about is about this. But we're getting ready to show people something.
Well, look, I think one of the coolest parts about Anita research and what you're doing, and you told me this when you started. You're like, all right, I'm going to take a year and I'm going to fully flesh out this idea with a bunch of research, right? And now the year has passed, we're a few months away. I'm excited for you, man. I think this is awesome. You've taken an approach that most people don't when they're going to launch a project or launch a business of their own. But now you're going in with, I mean, what I would assume is a ton of insight in how this can all work and allow you to have that elegant implementation, which I'm excited to learn more about in a few months.
Me too.
That's a wrap for us at the Compass Podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show.
So cool.
If you did, please subscribe.
Thank you for coming on the show.
It's great to get to chat with you on your preferred listening platform. Thanks again, everyone. The thoughts and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests on the Compass Podcast are their own and do not represent the opinions of Compass Mining, Inc. None of this content should be considered financial advice.